You are listening to the IEEE Computer Society Standard Speakers Series podcast, featuring acknowledged experts sharing the current state, knowledge, and benefits of computer-related standards. This program is supported by the IEEE Computer Society Standard Speakers Bureau, a joint coordinated effort between the chapters and standards activities boards of the IEEE Computer Society. It's designed to bring advanced and current computing standards information to local chapters. Please visit www.computer.org to learn more about this program, membership with the IEEE Computer Society, and the wealth of current technical information, community services, and personalized services for the world's computing professionals. Now, here is part three of Joe DeCure, recorded on February 5th, 2007 in Vancouver, British Columbia, speaking on the subject, Ultra Wideband Update, IEEE 802.15.4a, and ECMA 368.
Choices that we faced. The majority of the partisans that supported multiband, including myself, chose the multiband radio technically for the four following reasons. We didn't have to have the complexities of rake filters and tuning the rake filters. We had an all-digital design which scaled down as chip geometry got tighter. The frequency flexibility allowed us to adapt it to sell around the world. We didn't want to build a US-only radio. And in particular, the OFDM allows us to do a detect it and avoid to use more bandwidth in the places where we had other radios that we had to worry about. In contrast, Task Group 4A said, our data rates are low enough, we don't need the rake filters. We'll just burn enough chips per bit and not worry about it. That left them with lower complexity. That means less chip area. And the lower signaling rates as well reduce the power so much that you can run these things on a battery for a year. I want to do a short sidebar about the voting process, because IEEE 802 works differently than most standards development organizations. That's what SDO stands for. In 802, voting rights are earned and held by individual engineers. Anyone in this room, my wife the artist, could go to three consecutive meetings, pay $300-$400 to register at each one, show up to enough meetings, and earn voting rights. She knows a whole lot about color. She doesn't know anything about these other than what I tell her. But she'd have a vote. And if I brought her along, we could double our votes. That happened. So in most other standards developing organizations, they have entity voting. Intel gets one vote. Motorola gets one vote. IBM gets one vote. My company gets one vote. And oddly enough, all of you here, or the most of you here, are IEEE members, correct? You had to qualify in some fashion to be IEEE members. To earn voting rights, you don't have to be an IEEE member, you don't have to be a member of the Computer Society, you don't have to be a member of the Standards Association. What's with that? In this group, motions require 75% of voters present. Most other standards development organizations require consensus, and 75% usually doesn't cut it. You have to have an absence of principled dissent. So they work differently. So in 802, power depends on sending lots of voters. We had a situation where groups of companies whose economic footprints differed by 10 to 1 were still approximately equal within the committee, because the smaller group worked very hard to bring lots and lots of voters. And the winners were the airlines and the hotels. I like that one in Hawaii. In their voting rules, if you vote no, you have to say why. And it's supposed to be a technical reason. In principle, they can disqualify a no vote if you don't have a sound technical reason. But what's a sound technical reason can get slippery. And a lot of the voters were actually voting no because it's not the way my radio works. Any questions before I leave that subject? Good. All right. To the other group in 802.15, they had a .4 standard, low-rate personal area network. meaning if you recall at the time, Bluetooth had come out, it was 1 megabit per second signaling rate. So the low rate to them means 20 to 250 kilobits per second. Remember, I've been talking about ultra-wideband radios that are more than 1,000 times faster. The main applications from the Zigbee Alliance are home, industrial automation, home automation, sensor networks, and operating a long time on a single battery. So if you're using it in a factory, you might use it to track things. You might use it to control things. People put sensor, the military now puts sensor networks down in battlefields. They put sensor networks, they're developing sensor networks that can be laid out in a burning building and use ranging to track where the first responders are, even if they're unconscious. In the original standard, they still had multiple physical layer specs from the very cheapest and slowest to the ISM version at 0.25 megabit per second. Still 4 times slower than Bluetooth, but a whole lot cheaper. So when they opened up their Task Group 4A project, they were soliciting more ideas for a physical layer. And they came up with another one in the ISM band, which had nice impairment characteristics, but I'm not going to get deep into. And they came up with their own ultra-wideband proposals. And the group that was proposing direct sequence in TG3A also proposed it in 4A, but with different frequency options and simplified modulation. So they picked a band centered around 500 megahertz down in where TVs are. But we're talking very low powers here. They picked several bands in the low ultra-wideband area and a whole bunch more in the high band. I have got a slide about that. And in this version, being able to measure the range from one device to another is a required feature, which I'll get into later. So on the next slide here, here's what their band plan looked like 2 years ago, where in the low band, here's ISM, 3 to 5 gigahertz. So they would have three different channel possibilities that were 500 megahertz each, and one that was 1500 megahertz each. They had in the high band, here's 6 gig, and here's 10.7 gig. They had several narrow band channels and 3 wider band channels. And like I say, when they were looking at detection and avoidance, they would measure energy here, here, and here. And if one of those was busy, they wouldn't use it. And they would just use the one that appeared to be not busy, if they could find one. So for their ultra-wideband, it was a whole lot simpler. If you recall a few slides back, we were talking about modulation at 1,320 mega chips per second. And using one or more of those per bit. In this case, it's much simpler. The pulse rate is 500 megahertz, essentially. Different channel widths, but much smaller. There was a 3,500 megahertz one proposed in TG3A. Using the wider channels of those choices, here some of the channels are wide, some of them are narrower. The reason to use a wider channel is either you get more range, you spread your energy out over more, you mitigate multipath, and you get better spatial resolution when you're doing ranging. I'll explain that more later. So, imagining looking at it in time, there's little pulses, and the little pulse might be modulated in phase with respect to the previous pulse, and it might be positive and it might be negative. So they have what they call BPP, burst phase and position modulation. Logically, it's very simple, which means low power. Here's what the chain of components look like. I won't dwell on this, but you can all download this and look at it if you wish. Let me talk a little bit about this application of ranging. I was at Microsoft 7 years ago when Bluetooth came out. And we were imagining a world where lots of devices had short-range radios that could deliver lots of data. And the problem we were running into in 802.11 of association and security, we thought, would be much worse with Bluetooth. Because your device could find all these other devices, and how would you know which one to connect to? how could you automate that management in such a way that the user wasn't completely randomized all the time with your device finding other devices in the next car or the next floor or whatever. And I said, we need to be able to measure how far those other devices are and maybe set my device that it only alerts me about things that are within a meter or two so I don't hear everybody else in the room. We thought about it and we discovered that for Bluetooth, the frequency resolution doesn't do it. But when I joined this crowd 3 years ago, they said, we want ranging. And I said, yes! It was my chance. So, range measurement is practical at ultra-wideband. The spatial resolution is inverse to the bandwidth. So, let's suppose I want to measure the distance from me to the AV guy in the back corner. So let's say he's at 10 meters. If the spatial resolution is essentially speed of light over the bandwidth, so Bluetooth is only a megahertz bandwidth. Speed of light divided by megahertz is 300 meters. So I want to lay out a ruler to measure how far away the guy is, and the minimum granularity in my ruler is 10 times as far away as he is. I'm talking again. It's more than 10 times as far away as he is. I'm not going to be able to find him practically. But I've got a radio that's 528 megahertz. I get 57 centimeters. That's a little under 2 feet. If I use one of the wider bands, the widest band in the 802.15.4a radio, 1355 megahertz, I can get 22 centimeters, less than a foot, almost a little over 8 inches. I can measure distances practically now. Now, both this ultra-wideband standard and this one specify the similar time-based ranging mechanism. I'm to blame for that. But in this one, it's required, in this one, it's optional. In both cases, we considered signal power-based ranging, measuring how far away you are based on what your signal strength is. But those are extremely difficult to calibrate, because the signal can flow by so many different pathways and interference throws everything off. So we didn't go there. We used time because the speed of light is the law. So it's simple. Try to measure the time of flight, multiply by C. The trick is to accurately measure the time of flight given the real impairments, noise, multipath, logic delays in devices which are actually larger than the times of flight. Manufacturing process tolerances, crystal tolerances. I'm going to omit a lot of detail here. Also, given the application of association, how far away is that device? Am I willing to talk to him or not? We actually considered the problem of hackers attacking a Zigbee network and trying to pretend that they were closer than they are so that we would associate with them. And so 15.4a has simple mechanisms for encrypting the measurements. So if you don't have an encrypted relationship, then you can't measure range. If you can't measure range, you can't deceive the other device. So the mechanism that they both use is called two-way time transfer. The initiating device sends a signal. When I send the signal, start a stopwatch. Receiver gets the signal, starts her own stopwatch, turns around, sends me signal back, measures that time delay, because later that device will send me what that delay was. I stop my stopwatch when it arrives here, compensate for the device delays, subtract the difference, that's two times of flight. Multiply by C over two, and I've got it. Simple. In principle. This just lays it out and lays out the math. But it's relatively straightforward once you've done that. There are issues. In the case of this kind of thing, if you have reflected signals that are actually stronger than the line of sight signal, which is the shortest, your peak detector, the one that's looking for timing marks, will find the reflected one and home in on it rather than the straight one. In which case, what you'll really measure is the time of flight of the signal that got to you, which is not the same as the distance. So, for example, if I was ranging with the AV guy and there was an obstruction in the way and it was bouncing off the wall, I'm actually measuring the bounce path, not the straight path. So objects are closer than they appear. Just one of the points I alluded to. The flight times are not very long. You know, foot per nanosecond means 10 meters is, what, 30 nanoseconds. The delays in some of these parts, in particular in the signal processors that are detecting and generating these pulses, they have long finite impulse response filters. They may actually have much longer delays in the PHY than they will over the air. So the manufacturers of these devices have to calibrate what the delays are so that they can be nulled out before the calculations are made. This is a little block diagram, imagining that here's a transmitting device. It has its PHY digital signal processor. It sends out a signal and at the same time captures a timer, that stopwatch in the previous slide. And another one has its own stopwatch and latch to capture the results of when that's received. And then upper level logic will take the numbers out of those latches, those stopwatch measurements, and compare and contract and subtract them. What might you use ranging for? One of my friends in this group did a very funny slide. He listed many, many applications, but he said in his hometown in Huntsville, Alabama, the most popular application for ranging is answering the question, where is my teenage daughter? Now, in fact, these devices are useless for that. For low-rate ultra-wideband, the ranges aren't long enough for one thing. You might want to determine the spatial relationships in a sensor array or in a factory or in a home, because these things mesh network. They can talk to each other. They can measure each other's ranges, report them all back to a device, which then figures out where everything is so that when it collects information from them, temperature, salinity, whatever the things it's measuring, it can make that into a three-dimensional model of what's going on. I can imagine wanting to spread them around my neighborhood with little cameras because of the number of car burglaries we've had recently. You could locate moving devices in a factory. Most of you have heard of RFID devices by now. You may even have a pet that has one stuck into it. They're intended for tracking material, but their range is not very large because the RFID tags are not powered. They recover energy from the signal sent to them. And that severely limits, so that's wireless power. So that severely limits how far away they can be usefully. But these things, at low rates, can be 30 meters away, maybe 50 meters away. And if they've got ranging, then they can tell you exactly how far away they are. And so you could have a factory, let's say, with stations scattered around the building, all being able to make ranging measurements, and you could track the three-dimensional location of a device to a foot as it travels in the factory. The future, they'll have that. These systems have been developed and are being considered for locating people like firefighters or soldiers in a battlefield. Hopefully none of you will need them personally. For high-rate ultra-wideband, the applications are different. Like I say, the most attractive application at this point is for qualifying authentication and connection. Any questions about that? Yes, sir.
Out of curiosity, for the locating people, I assume that the sensors would all be dynamically located. How would you get an accurate positioning then? To say that you're 10 meters away from a sensor, how do you know where that actually is?
You have to triangulate. You have to measure your distance to more than one sensor.
So you
three
would
or four of them.
But if I'm understanding correctly, if you have several firefighters in the building and they're all moving around, how would that help you know where they are?
Because you also have to drop things that become location anchors. You have to have a few location anchors that are known position and then measure the distances to the moving objects or people. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Do the counters require perfect synchronization?
Excellent question. The first thing that those counters need is that they need to run at or faster than the spatial resolution. So for example, you'll probably run them at the frequency of the processing, like 528 megahertz or even higher. The second thing is, a critical problem is clock skew between the two watches. In the highest frequency ultra-wideband world, they're expecting to use 20 parts per million as the frequency tolerance on the crystals, which are not the cheapest crystals you can get, but they're looking for 10 to 20. And the longer it takes to make the measurement, the longer the time that both clocks are running, and therefore the larger the skew can be between the two, and those translate into ranging errors. In the TG4A application, Zigbee, they're trying to be really cheap. They're trying to use MEMS oscillators on the parts, and those are more like 40 parts per million, which means they lose the precision they pick up from being wideband, they then lose from crystal tolerance. So there's some limits to what they can do. Sometimes there are some proprietary techniques, not just for averaging, but for compensating in other ways. I wrote, if you download the ECMA standard, there is an appendix in it that talks about these errors and how to compensate for them. And one of the slides here has the URL for that standard, which is public. Does that answer your question?
Yes, yes. Thank you. And I have another question. It's, in 802.15.4a, do you still using peak detection for ranging, or you use different method?
Well, it's not just peaks. What you have to do is you have to delineate a particular sequence that's really distinguishable from anything else and gives you a very sharp, here's where it is coming out of the DSP. It's not just the peak of the signal, because the signals are all over the place. If you were simply doing, you know, peak energy of the radiated signal, you would be lost. So the digital signal processor running a big FIR filter is watching the signals coming in, and when it resolves to a particular signal, then it'll say, that's what I found. And part of the black art of doing ranging well is coming up with what is the signal that's easy to distinguish spatially from all other signals to use as your timing mark. Because if it's hard to resolve spatially, that immediately translates to range errors.
Okay, thank you. I have one last question. As in earlier 802.15.4 proposals, you have like about five different ranging methods. Do you still use the other ones?
Were you at any of these meetings?
No, I haven't been to those meetings. But
they looked at a variety of different time-based techniques, and the one I described in here is the one for one device to measure the distance to another device. They have other mechanisms that are supported in the standard so that if you have ranging anchors, devices in the known positions of more complexity than the minimum, either they put out beacons and the device measures the time it receives each beacon and triangulates where it is and then tells them, or it sends out a beacon and each of the ranging anchors picks it up and compares, synchronizes their time bases with a central one so they can measure when those beacons came in. So in the application I described in the factory, if you're trying to track a piece of material that's expensive and you want to know exactly where it is, you have it just send out a beacon and you invest in the ranging anchors to synchronize their clocks exactly. And so it just emits a little energy every once in a while. Transmitting is cheaper than receiving from an energy standpoint. So it just let it emit stuff every once in a while, and then that information will be collected, and the thing that's tracking things picks up those and figures out where they are.
Thank you for listening to the IEEE Computer Society Standard Speaker Series podcast. If you would like additional information on the standards discussed in this program, or would like to learn more about membership with the IEEE Computer Society and the advanced technical information available, please visit www.computer.org. Some of the music provided is from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com.